From the four corners of Southern California, this is The Hot Seat, and you're in it with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. I'm sorry it has been so long since I was last with you, but on the phone I have, as the first post-City Council District 4 guest, activist, author, and political commentator Earl Ofari Hutchinson. How are you, Mr. Hutchinson? Thank you very much for taking the time to call into The Hot Seat.
Yeah, very much. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Now, I have lots of questions and not a lot of time, so without further ado, let's get started. So, to start with, I feel like the public sees you quite often, and it seems that the public values your opinion, but I'm not sure how much people know about you. That being said, would it be possible to tell us a little bit about your background and how you became involved with the social justice movement in Los Angeles to head the LA Urban Policy Roundtable?
Well, actually, I wear many hats. It is true, I am president of the LA Urban Policy Roundtable. However, I'm also a writer, and I've had a syndicated column for a number of years that appears in a number of national publications as well as local publications. Also, I do quite a bit of radio, too. I've had radio shows and still do for a number of years on the Pacifica Network and in commercial radio and, of course, TV commentary. So it's been varied, and there's several things, I think, that connect the dots in my career, whether it's the Urban Policy Roundtable, whether it's radio, whether it's TV, or whether it's print journalism. The core really is this, that it's always an advocacy position. You know, what I try to do in my writing, in my speaking, my communicasting, and certainly with the community activities is I find issues, and usually issues find me, that are compelling, that are engaging, and that essentially really scream for action. So whether I'm writing about a particular issue or whether I'm engaged in it in some capacity as an activist or a commentator, it's got to be something there that I can sink my teeth in and also something where I see that I can make a real difference in terms of changing public policy. So that's always been the driving force behind all the things that I do and all the hats that I wear.
So, in all of the issues that you write about or get involved, or all the issues that are involved in your communication, whether it be speaking or writing, you always somehow get involved with it.
Well, yes, because to me, just writing and just speaking or, you know, doing radio programs or even with the organization, I mean, what's the point? It's really got to be not only a focus of energy and direction, but I like to see a result. What's going to come out of it? Am I going to be able to, by my engagement, really, really affect some kind of meaningful change, and more specifically, a public policy change? So a lot of people that are engaged in activism, and this has been the case over the years, it's almost like protest for protest's sake. I mean, there's no plan, there's no strategy, there's no end game to it. You know, one of my models, and I think one of the great models, actually two models, Gandhi and Dr. Martin Luther King, they always, always, in their protest campaigns and their actions, they had an end game in mind, something they wanted to change, not just something that they wanted to get out there in terms of making noise and sound. Anybody can do that. They wanted to change public policy. Obviously, with Gandhi, you know, it was independence for India. Obviously, with Dr. King, it was the end of legal segregation. So no matter what they did, whether they were writing, they were speaking, or their activism, they never lost sight of really what the goal was. And so I think the same with me. I like to see public policy changes, and I like to think that I'm a part of that, making that change.
Okay. And being in the perspective of the journalist, I can tell you that when you talk, people listen. And continuing on now with a specific case you were involved with, which is that of Marlene Pinnock, the woman who was beaten by a CHP officer on the 10 freeway this past summer. Her case is back in the news, but this time it's because of her attorney, Carrie Harper. Various media outlets reported that this attorney took more than $600,000 from the $1.5 million settlement, and Harper was recently held on contempt of court charges. Do you have an issue with how much money Ms. Harper made on this case?
Absolutely. Let me walk it back a second. The Marlene Pinnock case, and I think this is a classic example of what I mentioned a minute ago about changing public policy, and also much more. When the beating happened by a CHP officer, and that was the first week of July, my organization and some others, we get out front on that. called a press conference right at the site of the beating near the freeway. We called attention to it. The press picked up on it. And the rest is history. It became a major issue. But here's what happened. The California Highway Patrol, unlike in many cases with police departments, when they're literally charged with misconduct or abuse, and they get literally caught with their pants down, they circle the wagons. They go into a defensive posture. They essentially admit nothing, and they do nothing. So this was a little different. CHP actually did something. They fired the officer, and they recommended that charges be brought against him. And they went a little bit further, and this is where the public policy comes in. I'll bring it back to the attorney in a second to tie it in. And this is where public policy changed. We got a commitment from the California Highway Patrol to revamp their training, revamp their policies and procedures about the use of force, and most importantly, how they deal with those with mental challenges, which obviously Marlene Pinnock had. And I think that was important in terms of public policy change. So it wasn't just a brutal act that was caught on video and they had to do something about. We were talking about something much broader, public policy change. Now, enter the attorney. Attorneys always come in after the advocates make an issue, out of an issue. They usually command a settlement. And, you know, that's fine. I mean, obviously, if you're working on behalf of a client, and there's got to be some financial compensation for the injustice that was rendered to that particular person, and also the abuse and the pain and suffering that they incurred. There's nothing wrong with that. I mean, that's just the tried and true method of our legal system. Where it breaks down is two places, and it did with Marlene Pinnock. One, there's no question about it. If you got a settlement of $1.2 million that's earmarked specifically for Marlene Pinnock, her care, her treatment, her housing, the bulk of the money's got to go there, not half of it going to line the pocket of an attorney. That's not fair. That's not just by any standard. The second problem I have with that is, unfortunately, when you have a case like Marlene Pinnock and others, and I've seen this time and time again, attorneys right away who have really done nothing on the justice side of it or public policy side of it, shamelessly profiteer off of the work, the struggle, and also bringing public attention to an injustice of the activist. So I think at all levels, the judge in this case was absolutely correct with Carrie Harper suggesting, as the judge did, look, this is out of line. Something's wrong here. The judge didn't use the word profiteering, but I think that hung heavily in the air. So I think beyond that, what has to happen is when you have situations like Marlene Pinnock and Carrie Harper or any other situation, and they're going to come up again, it won't be the last time by any means, then I think that there's going to have to be a very close scrutiny, not only on the principles involved, whether it be family members or the victim or whoever, but also those that are having interest in justice being served. They have to look, too, at how settlements are conducted, the terms of those settlements, and most importantly, who gets what. At the end of the day, the victim or the person that's been victimized, they must be the one to profit, not anyone else.
And you said that the CHP officer was fired. I was under the impression he resigned, or was it a forced forced to resign?
What happened, they asked for his resignation. And in addition to that, they, according to the CHP commissioner, Jill Farrell, who I had extensive conversations with, he made it clear, what we're going to do is we're also going to turn over the findings of our investigation to the L.A. County District Attorney's Office. So I'm assuming he did.
And are you still waiting? I mean, obviously the officer hasn't been charged yet. Are you still pushing for him to be charged?
Yes, we did. And yes, we are. We called for that from day one. Not only did we call for the firing of the CHP officer, we also called for criminal charges to be leveled against this officer. Now, as we well know, that was a number of months ago. The wheels grind very slowly when it comes to bringing charges, as we well know, if they're brought at all, against law enforcement. Almost never does that happen. But at the same time, you still have to make the call because there's still got to be some element of accountability. If not, then law enforcement, and again, we're only talking about those that misuse their authority. That's all. those that abuse their authority, if they're not held accountable, then essentially what check and balance and protection do citizens have in a free society?
And one last question on this, and that is, are you or have you seen the CHP reforms that were announced? Have you seen them put into place yet?
What we've seen is two things. Number one, we've had open dialogue on several occasions with CHP officials, up to including Jill Farrell, the commissioner, and we talked about the timetable for putting and implementing the specific recommendations that they made, not that we made, that they made and said they would implement in place. So we have had that dialogue, and we've got assurances that it's moving at a pace. The one area that we have, actually two areas, that we have seen some very substantive change in right away. They revamped, according to the CHP, and they did this almost from day one. They revamped their training program, showing videotapes, orientation, workshops, all kinds of areas to facilitate with their officers how to deal with those that perhaps may have emotional or mental challenge issues, like Marlene Penny. So I think that's critically important because law enforcement deals with so many individuals that have emotional challenges. And oftentimes, as we've seen, things can go bad very quickly. The other area that we have certainly seen is the use of force. Since the Marlene Pinnock beating, we have not seen any that we know of reported incidents of misconduct, abuse, use of force by a CHP officer. I have to think that the reason we have not seen and or heard of any such thing is simply because the CHP, they've become very, very diligent internally about making sure that all officers in the line of duty at all times comport themselves legally and correctly.
Okay. And I'm going to take a short music break now, and we'll be back shortly to talk about the broader issue of racial tension. And I'm back now with author, political commentator, and social activist Earl Ofari Hutchinson. So, Mr. Hutchinson, addressing the broader scale of racial tension, there have been lots of incidents within the last year. Do you believe that, and beyond that, and it seems like it certainly hasn't stopped, do you believe that the Trayvon Martin incident is what caused all of these subsequent incidents, or do you believe that it was boiling over and the tipping point was the Trayvon Martin incident?
Well, I think even before Trayvon Martin, you know, we've seen all along, going all the way back to Rodney King and perhaps even before that. But there's always been, over time, a series of issues, incidents, flashpoints, conflict, tension between minority communities and police law enforcement agencies, especially African-American communities. Now, since Rodney King, as we well know, there have been a number of commissions, a number of reports, a number of studies, a number of surveys that have looked at this question. Why there's such tension, why oftentimes there's violence, but certainly conflict, mistrust, distrust between African Americans, Hispanics, and law enforcement. And the conclusion's always been, even before Trayvon Martin, that essentially that wall of distrust and mistrust has always been a product of kind of an us versus them mentality that unfortunately far too many police departments have. Not all, but far too many. And also police officials and city officials ingrained with that same kind of blue wall, a line between a community and their police department. I think a second area, too, is racial tension, racial stereotyping and negative typecasting. Unfortunately, as with Trayvon Martin, far too many police officers still see young African-American males as thugs, gangbangers, drug dealers, criminals, murderers, rapists, you name them. In other words, they are negatively typecast. So right away, when there's a confrontation or even an encounter between a police officer and a young African-American or Hispanic, essentially right away, they bring to the table so many preconceived negative notions, typecast, stereotypes about them. And unfortunately, what can happen at that point is violence can occur. Almost always, the victim's going to be a young Black or a young Hispanic, as was the case with Trayvon Martin, of course. Obviously, the murderer, and that's what he was, George Zimmerman, was not law enforcement. However, he was seen as quasi-law enforcement because he did have some, at one time, official position as a neighborhood watch guy. So that kind of, you know, really imposed upon him a kind of cloak of authority. So the same rules apply: police, minority, young African Americans. Second thing, Trayvon Martin did something a little bit different. Much of the violence, or at least the conflicts and encounters, are usually out of sight, out of mind, out of public view. But what happened with Trayvon Martin, even though there was no videotape, what happened was right away you had a national outcry and a national response from civil rights leaders, from Al Sharpton to the NAACP and all points in between, and the media jumped on it, saw it as a hot button issue and a sensational issue, and so of course that blew it out there too. So what happened was Trayvon Martin was a tipping point only in the sense that it brought dramatically national and even international public attention to the issue once again of police minority relations / tensions.
Okay, and one quick question. I know we're almost out of time. I just need a quick answer. What do you believe is the reason, or the two short reasons, why you believe racial tensions are as strained or as heightened as they are now?
All right, two reasons. One I've alluded to before. I think because this country still will not come to grips with, number one, all African Americans, particularly young African American males, young Hispanic American males, or any males of color, females too, they're not the enemy. They're citizens too. They're not inherent criminals. They're not inherent those that commit misconduct or misdeeds. So I think that's the one thing, getting rid of the stereotypes. There needs to be an intense educational campaign there, on the part of not only police officials, police departments, but also elected officials, too, at the highest and lowest levels. I think the second area is no accountability. I've always said this. If when you have an outrageous, clear violation of abuse by a police officer, then you have to treat that officer just like you would treat me or you if we commit a crime. In other words, we are going to be punished for it. There's going to be some penalty for that. So if you have a different standard in how you deal with police officers, it sends a message to the African-American, Hispanic communities, look, they're above the law. They're not going to respect the law when it comes to dealing with you, and therefore, why should you respect them? So you see the problem. So it's really kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, a cycle, if you will. One tension, one misconception, one lack of accountability feeds into the same thing on the other side. So you have a continuing, I can't say that strongly enough, over time, pattern of fear, distrust, violence, and of course, violence, fear, and distrust.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, and I look forward to exploring those deeper with you in another episode. But thank you very much for calling into the Hot Seat today, Mr. Hutchinson. It was a pleasure. The Hot Seat After Hour starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can subscribe to the Hot Seat's newsletter by clicking on the link on our page. Go to annenbergradio.org/podcast and click on the link underneath the Hot Seat's description and enter your email address. Thank you for listening. I hope you'll join me next time with 18th District State Senator Robert Hertzberg.